Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Specialist in Small Animal Surgery, Kevin Parsons. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this webinar. Today we're going to discuss some management strategies available for the successful treatment of chronic pain and osteoarthritis in the dog. And as you're all aware, I'm sure we're all presented commonly with cases of chronic pain, and then management can be really quite challenging, and there's lots of pieces and lots of options that we have available to try and help us achieve a successful outcome. The majority of this talk, we're really going to focus on the treatment of osteoarthritis because that is by far the most common cause of chronic joint pain in dogs. However, it's really important to remember that osteoarthritis is very rarely a primary disease in patients that present to us. And there can be underlying causes that initiated the osteoarthritis, but also that may need to be addressed and are persisting. So we need to think about other conditions like immune-mediated polyarthritis or septic arthritis, or whether there's underlying cruciate disease or an underlying neoplasm that really has to be addressed, in addition to thinking about the chronicity and the chronic condition of osteoarthritis, which is going to require ongoing management. So as I said, we're really going to focus more on osteoarthritis, but throughout we're going to be jumping back a little bit to some of the underlying or initiating causes. But if we think about osteoarthritis, we need to think about the progression of the condition. And osteoarthritis is a lifelong condition. Once an animal or person starts or develops osteoarthritis, that's going to progress throughout life and is going to require ongoing management. So firstly, we initially start with the initiating event. So that may be one of these underlying conditions, for example, elbow dysplasia, hip dysplasia, polyarthritis, septic arthritis. And then we start to get the inflammation form within the joint and the development of osteoarthritis. So as the animal ages, so as we progress through time, the pain and clinical signs associated with the osteoarthritis within an affected joint gradually increases. And that pain or clinical signs may be subclinical initially. So, you know, an animal may get to 4, 5, 6 years old, depending when osteoarthritis started. And we may not notice any clinical signs, obviously, but the condition still is progressing. Throughout this, though, in addition to the gradual progression of the underlying condition, we also get flare-ups of the conditions. And this might be when our attention is first raised to the problem. And so throughout this, as well as having the gradual progression of osteoarthritis, we get flare-ups throughout the life. And we need to think about managing these flare-ups as well as managing the underlying progression of the condition. Eventually, the condition will progress, and again, that varies from individual to animal to animal, but eventually we may end up resulting in what we call an end stage joint. And this is where the joint is so degenerate, there's so much inflammation that it may be refractory to treatment. And then we need to think about other options that we have available to us. So what is the aim of treatment? Well, the aim of treatment, therefore, is multiple. We need to think about long-term management. So we need to think about the general progression of the arthritis. We need to think about those flare-ups and how we're going to manage those. We need to think about exacerbating factors, and we need to think about halting and slowing the disease progression, if possible, and also potentially reversing the disease, although that's much more challenging, and our options for reversing disease are very limited at the moment. We need to address the underlying cause, if possible. And then we have two main groups of treatment. We have non-surgical or conservative treatment, and we have surgical treatment. And we need to decide when these are appropriate. And we need to be constantly re-evaluating the treatment options that we've got available to ensure we provide the optimum treatment at a given stage for a given patient at a given time of the condition. So which treatment is optimal? Is conservative or surgical? Well, as I alluded to, really, it's not a simple answer. We need to think about the side effects of treatments. We need to think about particular patient factors. We need to think about the quality of life factors for a particular animal, and we need to think about finances. So, for example, side effects of treatment. We may have dogs that are non-tolerant of anti-inflammatory medication, and so that may change the time when we think surgery is appropriate. The likelihood of treatment may vary depending on the age of the animal. So, for example, if you've got an old end-stage joint, then the likelihood of treatment success is going to be limited. Whereas if we have a young animal with mild hip discomfort, for example, then conservative treatment is more likely to be successful. So we need to think about the patient. We need to think about the quality of life in the medium and long term. And in relation to finances, then sometimes what may be seen initially as the most expensive treatment may actually in the long term work out cheaper. So osteoarthritis is a disease. I've said it progresses throughout the animal's life. There's a range of episodes that occur relating to flare-ups, but we also have other problems going on around the joint. We develop muscle atrophy, for example. So we may have muscle atrophy. We get release of inflammatory mediators within the joint, so inflammation within the joint. These cause further tissue damage and cartilage damage and synovial inflammation. And that not only has an effect on the joint and the surrounding muscles, but also we get central sensitization. And there's not time in this webinar to go into detail on the sort of pathogenesis of central sensitization, but it's another aspect that we need to think about in the management of chronic joint pain. If we think about what strategies there are for management of arthritis, then one figure that's presented in a commonly used textbook is the sort of management strategies that are currently used for management of canine arthritis. And by far the most common strategy that used is lifestyle changes, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later. As we move up the pyramid, there's other strategies that are available. We can think about weight loss, we can think about non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, acupuncture, nutraceuticals, polysulfated glycoaminoglycans, omega-3 fatty acids. And so there's a number of animals that are treated with these for relatively mild and moderate osteoarthritis. As we move up, we may then need to think about addition of second-line pain reliefs or more aggressive treatments like amantadine and gabapentin, so the off-license therapies, or even the use of steroids for the management of chronic joint pain. And then further up the pyramid, unfortunately, management can be challenging, and if quality of life is severely affected, then euthanasia definitely has to be considered. And at the top of the pyramid, the number of dogs actually receiving surgery for management of canine arthritis is relatively small. And I think there's so many surgical options available that there's scope for a lot of patients to introduce the surgery or surgical treatments earlier on in the course of the condition. Okay, so the other thing is, the slide seemed to have skipped, there's multiple or multimodal approach to conservative treatment. So in the last slide, the figure of the pyramid, there's lots of different treatment options available. So it's not just a case of picking one of those treatments and trying it, and if that doesn't work, picking another option and then trying that. We need to think about all the options that are available and tailor our treatment to the specific patient. And if we use the multimodal approach, then conservative treatment can be successful in a lot of patients. And the other thing I think is worth mentioning at this stage is that referral for conservative treatment is definitely an option. So there's lots of centres becoming available now that offer rehabilitation and physiotherapy, as well as having pain clinics available, where medication can be really tailored for the individual. And conservative treatment can be successful. We don't have to be rushing to surgery. You know, there's a previous study performed in 1987 where Alistair Barr looked at hip dysplasia, and a significant number of dogs with conservative treatment managed to avoid surgery. More recently, there's a study which maybe questions that a little bit more, where actually, according to vet owner assessments, conservative treatment is slightly less successful for management of, for example, hip dysplasia. However, it still is a consideration, and there's so many options available that we need to be using them and thinking about them. Okay, so running through some of the options that we have available, starting with activity modification. So I think activity modification is really one of the first measures we should be using in the treatment of chronic joint pain associated with osteoarthritis. And we need to find an appropriate level of exercise for a particular patient. So different dogs have different tolerances of exercise depending on their breed, the stage of the osteoarthritis, and the state of the joint. So we need to aim to meet the lifestyle expectations of the patients. We need to aim to develop muscle so that animals are more able to exercise and the joints are more readily supported. We need to think about regular exercise. So sometimes I'll have a patient that comes in with chronic joint pain, and actually the dog's coping relatively well, except when it does 2 hours of agility at the weekend. Well, maybe just by retiring from agility, the dog still may be able to enjoy a good level of activity, but maybe that 2 hours of agility at a weekend is just too much and it just can't cope with it, and we need to think about modifying that activity. Another example is where a dog, for example, is walked for maybe 10 minutes twice a day during the week, and then at weekend the whole family go on a hike for 8 hours and the dog's slightly stiff and lame. Well, I often say to people it's not totally surprising that they're stiff and lame after that amount of exercise, and we need to be moderating the exercise and ensuring they have regular amounts of exercise. The next really important aspect of conservative treatment is weight control. And this really, the importance of this can't be overemphasized. We've all seen dogs that have been overweight. We've all seen dogs that have benefited from weight loss. And there's a well-written and performed longitudinal cohort study looking into Labradors where a group had ad-lib feeding and another group had slightly restricted feeding. And the prevalence of arthritis in the ad-lib feeding group was significantly higher than those where diet was slightly restricted. Diet restriction, therefore, was shown to delay the onset and reduce the severity of osteoarthritis and affected the duration and quality of life. So weight restriction really is important. In relation to the appropriate way of achieving successful weight restrictions, well, I think most practices now have nurse clinics that are set up for ensuring and monitoring weight loss, and I think they're a great way of achieving that. Basically, it's we have to increase physical activity, we have to restrict energy intake, and we do have to be involved in regularly monitoring the weight of the patient. So owners can be happy that they're achieving an appropriate weight loss diet, or they can be guided if the weight loss isn't appropriate. Moving on now to non-steroidals. So I think exercise, activity modification, weight control are really important, and then non-steroidals are probably the next thing that most people reach for in the treatment. And there's a reason for that, and the reason being they're the only licensed treatment for long-term use in animals with chronic pain. And their use is supported by a large amount of data. You know, I don't expect you to be able to read those papers down the side, but there's numerous publications demonstrating the use of non-steroidals and the efficacy of non-steroidals in the treatment of chronic pain. There are, however, challenges to starting treatment, and those challenges include that owners may be unaware that their patient is in pain. So the dog may present to you at the time of vaccination, and after careful questioning, there may be some items that are discussed that sort of make us aware that maybe there is some discomfort in the patient. Owners may also question the benefit of non-steroidals, particularly if they are unaware that the animal is in pain. And in that situation, a therapeutic trial may be useful to demonstrate the effect of pain and discomfort on the patient. People and vets often have a big concern over the side effects of non-steroidals, and also in relation to the cost of treatment. And we'll talk a little bit about this more in a moment, but again, there's a lot to cover today, so we won't be dwelling on things. So in relation to non-steroids, we're aware that COX-1 and COX-2 is upregulated in dogs with naturally occurring osteoarthritis, and non-steroids are aimed at reducing COX production and therefore reducing inflammation and reducing discomfort. And as I mentioned before, side effects can happen. The most common side effects observed really are associated with the GI tract, and so we need to be careful when we start treatment. But I think of most importance in relation to treatment is making sure we follow the guidelines. So if a dog is off the food, then non-steroidals should be withheld. If it's anorexic, if it's got a fever, if we're concerned about perfusion, then non-steroidals should be withheld. And most of the dogs that I see, unfortunately, out of hours with complications that are associated with non-steroidals, typically non-steroidals have been administered when there's been a contraindication and maybe they should have been withheld. So, for example, a dog's off food, it's in discomfort, and so instead of giving oral anti-inflammatories or non-steroidals, they're given injectable non-steroidals because they're off the food. Well, really, the fact that they're anorexic and off the food should be an indication not to withhold non-steroidal treatment. So I think if they're carefully used, the incidence of side effects are used are low, and if we use them and follow the guidelines, then I think generally they're relatively safe. The other interesting thing with non-steroidals is different dogs do seem to respond differently to different non-steroidals. So we may have a dog, for example, that's receiving meloxicam and having a relatively poor outcome, or maybe it's become a bit refractory to the treatment. And just by switching to a different non-steroidal with an appropriate washout period, and then starting a different non-steroidals, those dogs seem to respond differently, and we don't really understand why. And it's not that one is better than the other. So, for example, one dog may do better on carprofen, another may do better on meloxicam or rebenacoxib, and so different dogs do respond differently. And that's useful when we're having dogs that aren't doing particularly well on treatment, that we've got this option of trying different anti-inflammatory medications. The other question is, should we be using COX preferentials or COXIBs? The side effects with both are low. I think, to be honest, in my opinion, there's some benefits of one, of maybe some over the other, but generally they all, as long as we're using a licensed product and are following the guidelines, then generally the side effects are low with both, and it's just determining which is most appropriate for that owner in terms of formulation, and also which achieves the best result for a particular patient. Another aspect to consider with non-steroidals is, do we think about dose titration? And dose titration is an interesting area. I think we shouldn't be using higher than the licensed dose. That's clearly been demonstrated to increase the risk of adverse effects. Is titration to a lower dose useful? Well, I do try and titrate because I think it's good to have a lower dose if possible, but it's also important if we are titrating that we're also getting a good clinical response. And I think that's the thing that's really challenging, is to monitor and make sure owners are titrating because of clinical response, not just to try and give them less medication and then the pain pathways start to set in again. And intermittent versus continuous dosing. So there's another aspect we need to consider with non-steroidals. And there's actually relatively little evidence to support intermittent that compares intermittent versus continuous dosing. One aspect to think about is breakthrough pain does make management more difficult. So if we're using intermittent therapy, we're giving non-steroidals, and then we stop for a period, and then we give another dose of non-steroidals. Well, if the pain pathways or pain has broken through, then it may be harder to bring the animal back into a comfort zone. And so in that respect, continuous therapy may be better at reducing osteoarthritis flares, and also it's questionable whether intermittent therapy actually reduces the risk of side effects as well. So generally I prefer continuous therapy, although different people may differ in their opinion. Okay, so the next part of conservative treatment really is physiotherapy. And I think physiotherapy centers are becoming more and more available and more accessible, and owners are becoming open up to this world of physio. And I think physio does have a huge amount to offer in relation to treatment of patients with chronic joint pain. The benefits of physiotherapy are that they physiotherapy can reduce inflammation. It can reduce and minimize muscle atrophy and be used to improve muscle strength and muscle mass. It provides positive psychological effects both to the patient and to the owner. It can be helpful in reducing periarticular contraction, so increasing joint range of motion, which in turn improves outcome. It can improve blood supply and lymph flow to the joint. It can be useful in restoring normal joint function, particularly range of motion. And also, I've had a lot of cases where appropriate physiotherapy has allowed me to reduce the amount of medication or the number of medications that a patient has to receive to have adequate control. The benefits, well, the benefits of physiotherapy or the methods of physiotherapy that we have available, there's numerous methods, and I think we need to make sure that appropriate professionals are using these methods. So there's lots of options. There's cryotherapy, thermotherapy, laser therapy, shockwave treatment, therapeutic ultrasounds. There's lots and lots of different options that have available for physiotherapy, and I think they have to be used appropriately by an appropriately trained person, and on their own they may not. So for example, just having a laser and just going ahead with laser treatment without thinking about other aspects of physiotherapy, in my opinion, probably isn't the best way of treating these patients. And which cases will benefit from each modality? Well, you know, the jury's still out, and there's different evidence suggesting different options, and I think the main thing is again having a professional who's appropriately trained to select the appropriate methods for a particular case. Hydrotherapy as well. So hydrotherapy is an excellent means of exercising. I think it provides many positives to the patient, not just in terms of improving muscle mass, but also in terms of reducing weight in patients. So it's a good method of exercise, improving the mental state of the patient, and it provides a reduced stress environment for muscles and joints to recover. In capitals there, the treatment must be designed for the individual. And this is similar to the last slide in that it's really important that we don't just take our dog and throw it into the hydrotherapy pool, let it swim for half an hour and then take it out. The treatment needs to be tailored for the individual. And interesting, there was a publication or a study performed not so long ago that demonstrated 49% of staff working in centres of hydrotherapy have no nationally recognised qualification. And so I think training is really important. And just like the presence of CT, so anyone can go out and buy a CT or an MRI scanner, but it doesn't really define the skills of the clinicians working in that practice. And so we need to be thinking about, is the hydrotherapy being performed by an appropriate individual? Moving on to acupuncture. So acupuncture, again, is becoming increasingly used for the management of chronic joint pain. The evidence for acupuncture is variable. The critical reviews are lacking. There's a limited number of studies or appropriate studies where we can confidently say it offers a scientific or proven benefit. However, the evidence is growing. And I think, you know, there are dogs that do seem to benefit from receiving acupuncture. There's a study that demonstrated dogs are less likely to require rescue analgesia if they're receiving acupuncture. And it has been used for thousands of years and is safe and has been demonstrated to be safe over those years. So again, I think it's another addition to our conservative treatment options it can be a useful method. Okay, so now you're moving on to the minefield of nutraceuticals, and again, we're bombarded with different types of nutraceuticals that can be used for the used in cases of chronic joint pain. What is a nutraceutical? Well, a nutraceutical is a food or part of a food that allegedly provides health benefits, and the typical ones that we see are chondroitin, glucosamine, essential fatty acids, and UC2. And the literature is definitely confusing, and I find, you know, every time I look into the literature a bit more, I get almost more confused as to what are the best options available. I could talk about this for hours, but I'd probably just confuse myself and you. But generally, just to run through the options that are commonly available in relation to chondroitin and glucosamine, the strength of evidence is relatively low, and the effects are questionable, and the results of study are often contradictory. You know, there's been studies that have shown it may offer some benefits in our patients. There's been other studies that have shown it doesn't offer benefit, and oral preparations may not reach the articular cartilage. If it does reach the articular cartilage, then in some human studies it's been demonstrated to have moderate anti-inflammatory effects. So again, the jury's out. I think, you know, yes, it's another option, but I don't think it's going to be the magic, or it isn't the magic solution for management of chronic joint pain, but may offer some limited benefits. Another product that's become more recently available is undenatured collagen type 2, so UC2. And UC2 promotes the reduction in inflammation and swelling within the joint, and therefore has been demonstrated to reduce joint pain through oral tolerization of undenatured collagen. There has been a study that demonstrated the daily treatment of arthritic dogs with UC2 alone or in combination with glucosamine and chondroitin did alleviate some of the signs associated with arthritis. However, it took a long time to take effect, and the maximum effect was reached by around day 150. So a bit like chondroitin and glucosamine, the undenatured collagen or UC2, I think, needs to be given long term. It is well tolerated, and there's not any reported side effects, and there has been a reasonable paper in the human literature where it demonstrated benefits in patients suffering from knee arthritis. So again, I think it's another useful addition to our treatment options. Omega-3 fatty acids are another option available, and I think omega-3 fatty acids, of all the nutraceuticals, I think these are the ones that I would recommend that people administer to their pet if it has chronic joint pain or has a joint condition. It's been demonstrated to be efficacious in several studies, and it's demonstrated an improvement in weight bearing in patients that receive it, the options for administering, well, it's available in a number of joint specific diets. It's also present in collard oil, so sometimes I'll just tell owners to administer collard oil at half the adult human dose, depending on the size of the dog though. And then also it's available in some of the sort of commercially available products that can contain a broad range of nutraceuticals like UC2, omega-3 fatty acids, chondroitin and glucosamine. So I think there's a range of ways of giving it. But of all the options that I've just talked about in terms of chondroitin and UC2 and omega-3s, I think omega-3s is the one with the most evidence supporting its use. Moving on, polysulfated glycoaminoglycans is another option that's available, and there's a moderate level of confidence in its use in a review paper. Structurally, that's similar to glycosaminoglycans in articular cartilage and may modify the progression of arthritis by inhibiting oligomeric matrix protein within the joint, so may have some benefits. And then pentazan polysulfate, is a disease-modifying osteoarthritic drug, and that may retard articular cartilage degeneration. It may stimulate cartilage cell differentiation, and it's licensed for use in osteoarthritis, that's Cartrophin. And there's a moderate level of comfort in recommending its use. It's not a product that I've used an awful lot. I think most cases that present to me in sort of a referral hospital have had this treatment previously. So again, it's not a product that I have an awful lot of experience with, but the evidence out there does suggest that it's moderately effective. Okay, so that's sort of the nutraceutical areas. And finally, well, another option for conservative treatment that is becoming more commonly available is the use of regenerative medicine. And this is really at a very early stage, and the mechanisms behind its perceived benefits are not yet fully understood. And we've started using regenerative medicine, that being either platelet-rich plasma or interleukin receptor 2 antagonist or stem cell therapy. And we've used this in a number of patients, and the outcome seems to be variable, although there are limited controlled studies looking into the use. So further research is definitely needed. I think it's an interesting area. I think in the future it will become more and more available. But I think before everyone rushes out and starts injecting stem cells in the joint, it'd be useful to understand the mechanisms behind the success or failure of the treatment a little bit more, so that it's just not randomly put into lots of joints without knowing what the outcome might be. In relation to pain management, then, we've mentioned non-steroidal anti-inflammatories as the mainstay of treatment because they're the licensed product that's available. We do have some other options that sometimes we have to reach for. Options include paracetamol and codeine. So paracetamol, as in PAR-DL5, is licensed for use for 5 days. However, we sometimes do use continuous therapy of paracetamol. There's limited safety and efficacy studies, and the codeine's unlikely to be bioavailable in dogs, so I think that's not the part of this a PAR-DL that's actually having the effect. But paracetamol is definitely useful. Then there's also off-label use of tramadol. So tramadol again is becoming commonly used. We see lots of dogs that have received tramadol. It modifies the pathway of pain, so it acts on opioid receptors. The data supporting use again is variable, although I think we definitely do see a clinical response with it, and we need to make sure we're using the appropriate dose. But I don't think this should be used in preference to non-steroidals, particularly because it's off license, and typically this wouldn't be my first line of treatment for chronic joint pain unless there was a contraindication or a need, a contraindication to non-steroidals or a need for additional pain relief. Gabapentin is another treatment that we sometimes use in the treatment of chronic joint pain. So these are typically patients that come in and have had chronic pain and have central sensitization. So they may act synergistically. Gabapentin can act synergistically with opioids. However, it may cause sedation and drowsiness. And then the other product is amantadine, which again is useful, and I probably use this much more commonly than gabapentin personally. So I'll often combine amantadine in cases where the pain is chronic and non-steroidal seem to be having limited effect. Okay. The other medication that I've, unfortunately, the slide seems to have disappeared, is corticosteroids. So I think corticosteroids is definitely a useful treatment, but really should be reserved for cases that become refractory to other treatments. So I don't have a problem with using steroids in cases where other treatments have been exhausted, but I don't think they should be used as the first line of treatment. And there's so many options that we've talked about that that tailoring medications and using different medications and physiotherapy and other options, we can often get animals under control, the pain under control, without having to rush to the use of corticosteroids. Obviously, they should never be used in combination with non-steroidals. So another common presentation or another presentation where we see side effects potentially of gastric ulceration associated with non-steroidals is where they've been used simultaneously with corticosteroids. Steroids can also be used locally, so we can give intra-articular injections of steroids, and again, that can offer benefit and potentially reset inflammation within the joint, which can be repeated intermittently to improve comfort in patients. If we're using conservative treatment, then we really do need to follow up treatment, and we need to evaluate. So it's not just a case of seeing a dog, giving it a non-steroidal, saying see you next year, and then letting the owner carry on and sort of tinker with medication themselves. We should be evaluating these patients. It's a disease process that's progressing throughout their life, and some of the signs of chronic pain are not always recognized by owners. It's more of a problem in cats, to be honest, but you know, just generally, it's amazing how many owners, if you do a therapeutic trial of non-steroidals, how they see a clear benefit and didn't realize how restricted their dog's activity had become prior to starting pain relief medication. As I mentioned earlier, treatment of osteoarthritis and chronic joint pain requires multimodal treatment. So it's a puzzle. We need to find which pieces of the puzzle work for a particular patient and prioritize the ones that work. Different dogs require different pieces to complete that puzzle, and we should be thinking of all those options and pulling them together for the patient. Okay, so that's really a quick flying through of the conservative treatments that are available. There are also surgical treatments, and I think traditionally a lot of the surgical treatments, as we saw from that pyramid early on in this presentation, a lot of the surgical treatments are not really thought about, or not many animals are given the option of having surgical treatments. And I think as surgery becomes more and more advanced, we need to be considering the surgical treatments throughout the course of the disease. And of the surgical treatments that are available for management of chronic joint pain, we have an arthrodesis surgery, joint replacement surgery, excision arthroplasty surgery, osteotomies, and those may not be necessarily for treatment of chronic joint pain, but they can be useful in cases where chronic joint pain is going to happen in the future. And we'll talk about these in a moment in relation to elbow dysplasia. And then another surgical treatment is sort of joint debridement, arthroscopy, micropick surgery, and again, we'll mention some of these throughout. So these next slides really are a little bit of a shopping list of different surgeries that are available for specific joints, really to raise your awareness of what surgical options are available. So if you're struggling, if medical management isn't successful, or if, for example, an owner really doesn't want to have lifelong medication, would consider surgery at an earlier date, then, as I say, this working through the different joints, hopefully by the end of this, we'll have an idea of what surgeries are available for particular joints. So we're going to talk about the shoulder, the elbow, the carpus, the metacarpal, metatarsal, phalangeal joints, the hip joints, the stifle, and the tarsus. Okay, so in relation to the shoulder, well, the treatment options for shoulder arthritis fall into, again, surgical and conservative. So conservative treatment that we talked about, and then there's also arthrodesis surgery available, and then there's total shoulder replacement surgery, although total shoulder replacement surgery isn't available for the masses at the moment. There's not a commercially available shoulder replacement implant available. Implants are typically custom designed. My experience of shoulder arthritis is a lot of dogs respond really favorably to conservative treatment with appropriate physiotherapy, range of motion exercises, and appropriate pain relief. And I've seen a few dogs where I think they're going to need an arthrodesis or shoulder replacement, but after a decent course of appropriate tailored conservative management, have had a really successful outcome. Arthrodesis surgery is available. It does impair mobility, although dogs cope surprisingly well with arthrodesis surgery, although they can be left with a mechanical lameness. So in relation to treatment of chronic pain, it can be a good successful outcome. The elbow is probably the joint that we're presented with most commonly, and it is a challenging joint. And there's loads of different options out there available. And when I talk to different vets, different specialists, everyone seems to have a slightly different recipe as to how they manage. And I think that's a reflection of the lack of really strong evidence to support specific procedures. So to run through some of the options for elbow arthritis, well, arthroscopy and debridement is a commonly performed procedure. So we're typically presented with a dog that has chronic joint pain. On CT, it has severe degenerative changes. On the radiograph on this screen, this dog had a large either fragmented or ununited anconeal process that's chronic, or an osteophyte. And I think here it's more likely to be a large osteophyte that may be separated from the main part of the anconeus. And so we see a number of dogs where CT demonstrates they've got severe OA and severe pain. Well, it's important in these cases to rule out sepsis as the cause of deterioration in lameness. And then one option that is available is to arthroscopically examine this joint and potentially remove the large fragments of bone like this osteophyte. And I've seen a few cases where debridement has resulted in significant improvement. Similarly, though, so we say to owners, I've seen a large number of cases where we haven't gone to surgery and they've decided to elect for conservative treatment, and those dogs have responded well to physiotherapy and appropriate pain relief medication. So I think my typical approach to these cases now is if they don't respond to conservative treatment, then I'll step in with a surgical procedure. The other benefit of arthroscopy is it allows us to assess the cartilage within the medial compartment. So here we've got an intraoperative arthroscopy image. Here we have the relatively cartilage, but you can see in the medial compartment here the severe full thickness erosion of the cartilage. So this cartilage here should be over the whole joint, whereas here we have a severe erosion of the cartilage. So if a joint is looking like that on arthroscopy, then again our expectations of our management, even if we're debriding bits of bone and things, are going to be more limited because that joint is severely affected, and so the prognosis for that is much worse. As I mentioned earlier, there are osteotomies available which can be used early in the course of elbow dysplasia. So again, another image from arthroscopy where we have the lateral compartment with cartilage, and then here the medial compartment with severe cartilage erosion. And so there are options for osteotomies to unload the medial compartment and potentially load the lateral more healthy compartment and hopefully allow some healing within the medial compartment with fibrocartilage. And so the aim is to reduce medial compartment load transmission. The osteotomies that are available for that, well, there's the sliding humeral osteotomy. And the results of publications, there's two or three main publications relating to this. A series by Noel Fitzpatrick looked at 59 limbs undergoing sliding humeral osteotomies, which is a major operation to undertake in a dog where we cut the humerus and we do this phase shift of the distal humerus to unload the medial compartment. The complication rate reported in that study is relatively low, with only 4.8% major complications, and the complications seem to be reducing as the plate evolves, and all of those dogs demonstrated a really good improvement in their lameness. Another study, a more recent study performed in the States, demonstrated using the same technique, demonstrated that all dogs had improved grain reaction force after sliding humeral osteotomies. However, the complication rate in that study, particularly with major complications, was significantly higher. So I think the jury, in my opinion, is still out a little bit on sliding humeral osteotomies, in that I think it's a very aggressive surgery that may offer some benefits in the treatment of medial compartment disease. However, it'd be nice to see more evidence supporting its use. The other procedure that's become available relatively recently is the proximal abducting ulnar osteotomy as well, which is a PAUL. And I think my opinion is it's sort of a less aggressive sliding humeral osteotomy, where we perform an osteotomy of the ulna and we apply a plate that unloads the medial compartment. And I've had a few cases where I performed the surgery and it seems to result in an improvement in their lameness where there's severe medial compartment disease. So these, again, are the dogs that don't have an end-stage joint, may have only mild to moderate osteoarthritis, but have severe erosion of the cartilage within the medial compartment. And so we're trying to prevent the development of osteoarthritis or slow the development of osteoarthritis in these. So as I said, I've used this in a few cases. The outcome, you know, owners are often pleased. But there is there's very limited evidence really in the literature supporting its use, and we're still waiting for controlled studies demonstrating the efficacy of this procedure. Another option is a canine unicompartmental elbow replacement. So that's an alternative to the sliding humeral osteotomy or PAUL. And basically, this is where we resurface part of the joint. It's not a procedure that I've had an awful lot of experience with. However, some people have reported good outcomes. But again, the evidence in the literature supporting its use is quite limited. So those are the osteotomies. So moving on from the osteotomy, so they can be used relatively early in the course of chronic elbow pain. Moving later on, we've got total elbow replacement. So this can be used for the treatment of end-stage joints, end-stage elbows, or elbows with chronic joint pain. So the indications for elbow replacement are when there's severe intractable degenerative joint disease that's poorly responsive to medical management. And typically, I think the elbow is a challenging joint to replace, and there's still limited evidence supporting the different elbow replacement systems that we have available. And so typically elbow replacement is restricted to cases where there's an unsatisfactory response to conservative treatment and conservative treatment's been exhausted. The two systems that are most readily available are the Tate elbow replacements, which we have experience with here in Bristol. And this is a cementless humeral component and cementless radial ulna component. And then the other system that's being developed is the Sirius elbow replacement, which is resurfaces the ulna and does preserve some pronation and supination. But for both of these treatments, there's limited objective outcomes because the cases they're being performed on are relatively low in number at the moment. And then finally, arthrodesis. So arthrodesis is an option for end-stage elbows. It's a salvage procedure and it does result in acceptable function, although it is a major operation. I think it's most commonly performed now following complications associated with elbow replacement surgery, but it can be thought of for use in treatment of chronic joint pain if it's unresponsive to a conservative treatment where joint replacement may not be an option. It does result in an abnormal gait in all dogs, but hopefully it's a pain-free mechanical lameness. Moving down now to the carpus then. So the carpus is a joint that's commonly affected with degenerative joint disease, but often I think is often an incidental finding. But in some cases, there is pain, particularly in cases that have had polyarthritis that have then developed degenerative joint disease secondary to that. And for these joints, pancarpal arthrodesis or partial carpal arthrodesis is an option. In relation to pancarpal arthrodesis, there's a case series in 2008 where 97% of owners reported that their gait improved following arthrodesis, although not all of those were treated for degenerative joint disease. And 74% reported that the animals walk or ran normally after carpal arthrodesis. I often say to people that the outcome is generally good because I think it is. However, a lot of patients can be left with a slight mechanical lameness after this procedure. But again, hopefully a pain-free mechanical lameness. In relation to partial carpal arthrodesis, good results are reported following this surgery. My experience of this is less. I've performed it in a number of cases. However, I think for the treatment of chronic joint pain associated with degenerative joint disease, its use is definitely more limited because often degenerative joint disease isn't limited to the distal or the carpal, metacarpal or intercarpal joint. It's often involving the radial carpal joint as well. And partial carpal arthrodesis doesn't stabilize the radial carpal joint. It only stabilizes the more distal joints. So this operation needs to be chosen in cases potentially where, for example, there's ligament instability in the distal joints, for example, that's not affecting the proximal joint of the carpus. Moving down now to the metacarpal and metatarsal phalangeal joints. So these joints, I think, are often arthritis in these is often identified. I think it's often underdiagnosed as a cause of lameness. And I've seen dogs where, you know, one particular case that I always remember is one that was referred for total hip replacement surgery. And we identified metatarsal phalangeal joint osteoarthritis that was really painful, and appropriate treatment of that meant that the dog then returned to a good level of exercise and didn't need hip replacement surgery. So it's often an incidental finding, but I think it's important to manipulate those digits to identify whether there is pain associated with those small joints. And it is a cause of a clinical lameness. One of the problems with this is often multiple joints are affected. And so again, it makes treatment challenging. So the treatment options for arthritis in these joints, well, the treatment options include excision arthroplasty. And I've performed this in a number of dogs where if there's a clearly painful metatarsal or metacarpal phalangeal joint, then I can perform an excision arthroplasty, and that often results in a good outcome. Unfortunately, these dogs sometimes have problems in other joints as well, so it's always, you know, the outcome can be limited by that. Other options include amputation or arthrodesis of the digit. Amputation, I think, it can be performed after an excision arthroplasty if an excision arthroplasty is unsuccessful. My experience of arthrodesis is not great for digits. Maybe I've just been unlucky, but it definitely wouldn't be my first line of treatment. So here's an example of an excision arthroplasty in a metacarpal phalangeal joint, and that forms a pseudoarthrosis. The foot anatomy is restored, and I've seen, you know, dogs respond very favorably to that surgery. Okay, so now to move on to the back leg. So again, moving down the surgical options for OA, chronic joint pain in the hind leg. So hip. In relation to the hip is one of the most commonly presenting joints affected by osteoarthritis, and the treatment options that we have available include total hip replacement surgery, femoral head and neck excision surgery, and denervation, which we won't talk about today because I think the efficacy is limited. So in relation to total hip replacement surgery, so total hip replacement surgery is well established. It does provide effective pain relief, and it does result, when successful, in a really good outcome. And I think, again, owners, I think hip replacement is so commonly performed now that we can consider this much earlier in the course of disease than we would consider an elbow replacement. And often cases are referred to us to discuss hip replacement surgeries. I'd always discuss conservative treatment first and exhaust conservative treatment first. But I think it's a good opportunity early in the course of hip OA for owners to be made aware of all the options that are available to them. So hip replacement surgery, we need to select appropriate patients. The patient needs to be an appropriate age, although age really isn't much of a limiting factor now. We can perform it in relatively young dogs from about 6 months of age through to geriatric and older dogs. We need to obviously preoperatively screen. We need to check for neurological conditions, and we need to check that they're a suitable candidate radiographically. So a couple of examples of hip replacements that have been performed. Well, the first case here, case one, is a dog that had a hip luxation from following a fall. The dog in its history clearly did have hip clinical symptoms consistent with chronic joint pain and OA in that hip, in that the owner reported a moderate intermittent lameness. However, they did want to try a toggle procedure first to reduce the hip, but this dog had ongoing lameness, and so this was eventually revised to a total hip replacement, and the outcome from that was excellent. And then a typical young dog with an almost luxoid hip, so the hip's very subluxated, there's degenerative joint disease, and you know, this was performed in a young dog, and again, this allowed the dog to have a good quality of life. Bilateral surgery can be performed if necessary. Most dogs don't require bilateral surgery. I've got a case in actually this morning that I operated on 2 years ago and did the first side, and it's now starting to get intermittent lameness on the second side. And I think, you know, we will perform bilateral surgery in that case, but a lot of cases don't need it. And there's a range of systems available. And the system that we use is the biometric hybrid system, which can be cemented and non-cemented. There's also other systems that are available on the market. Most dogs following hip replacement surgery return to good function. 95% have an excellent outcome. There can be complications. I'd be lying if I said there's no complications. Usually we can address those complications, but I think it's always important to counsel owners prior to surgery about potential complications that can occur. And the complication rate, as I said, is relatively low, and can include luxation, fracture, subsidence, and infection, which is probably the worst of all the complications that can happen. The femoral head and neck excision is the other surgery that we have available, and this is a salvage procedure. I think traditionally it was step two very quickly, particularly in cats and small dogs, as a good outcome. However, there have been studies that have demonstrated that the outcome from femoral head and neck excision clearly isn't as good from total hip as from total hip replacement in both young and large and small breed dogs and cats. The main problem with femoral head and neck excision is there's often an ongoing lameness, and this can be because of limb shortening, so it can be a mechanical lameness. Also, the affected limb often has muscle atrophy and decreased range of motion, which can be associated with discomfort. And also, patella luxation can occur more commonly following femoral head and neck excision. So cats and small dogs can do very well with femoral head and neck excision, but as I said, I think the outcome, if hip replacement is an option, the outcome from hip replacement is likely to be superior. And I've done hip replacements in small dogs, little Westies and things, where the neck, border terriers, where the next day they're walking really well on that leg, whereas you wouldn't typically expect that following a femoral head and neck excision. There's an interesting study published in 1997 that looked at the outcome of dogs following and cats following femoral head and neck excision. And despite the fact we say, you know, most dogs, cats do well, only 38% of cats had a good outcome, 20% had a satisfactory, and 42% had a poor outcome. So I think, yes, is satisfactory good enough? Well, personally, I'd rather have a good outcome. And so I think, you know, I think we should be giving these smaller patients the opportunity of hip replacement if that is an option, both financially or in terms of management relating to that owner. Moving down to the stifle joint, well, stifle arthritis is pretty common following cruciate disease, which is probably one of the most common conditions we see. It's unusual that stifle arthritis warrants total knee replacement, although we do see some cases, particularly following chronic infection or if cruciate disease has been left untreated, where total knee replacement may become indicated, or arthrodesis or even a trochlear groove replacement is an option now. So the total knee replacement is a cementless femoral component, a cemented tibial component. It's not available for small dogs, and there's limited data on its use at the moment. But the outcome from it, you know, there's encouraging results from the few cases that have been performed here and also from cases performed elsewhere. Obviously, if that isn't an option or if it fails, then stifle arthrodesis is an option. Similar to elbow arthrodesis, it will result in a mechanical lameness. It's not as well tolerated as arthrodesis of the shoulder, carpus and tarsus, and often circumduction of the limb is seen. So I think, you know, it is an option that's available. And then patella groove replacement. So this is limited to conditions where osteoarthritis is limited to the trochlear groove and may be useful in cases of patella luxation where arthritis is localized to that compartment of the joint. And patella groove replacement replaces the trochlear groove with a low friction, scratch resistant surface. And the outcome from that is encouraging, although again, publications pertaining to its outcome are still limited. Moving down to the tarsal joint, so there's, I think this is the final joint. So arthrodesis of the hock is probably the most common method used available for treatment of chronic joint pain in the hock. And the options are pantarsal arthrodesis, where we fuse the whole joint, or partial tarsal arthrodesis, where we fuse the smaller joints. And partial tarsal arthrodesis is definitely more common than partial carpal arthrodesis. But I think, again, we need to be making sure that disease is limited to the joints that we're arthrodesing. If there's degenerative joint disease within the tibio-tarsal joint, then partial tarsal arthrodesis can't expect it to be successful. In the future, and not too off, I think there's going to be a customized joint replacement for the tarsus available, so that'll be another consideration. And here's radiographs of pantarsal arthrodesis, We can use customized plates. So this was a case of a fracture that I had that was periarticular and developed severe degenerative joint disease in that carpus. And eventually we did a pan tarsal arthrodesis in that case. And then a partial tarsal arthrodesis, which allows ongoing movement of the main joint of the hock, i.e. the tibiotarsal joint. And so function postoperatively in those is excellent. The other treatment option that we have available is obviously euthanasia, and I think we need to consider euthanasia in these cases, because if joint pain really is chronic and debilitating and surgery isn't an option or surgery is failed, then we need to think about the welfare of the patient. So it needs to be discussed and needs to be given as an option to the owner in patients of severe chronic joint pain. Okay, so diagnosis of osteoarthritis is obviously a diagnosis we commonly make. We need to constantly reevaluate our options of treatment. We need to monitor and assess our response. We need to then put into place an action, whether that's weight control, exercise modification, non-steroids, whether we're then introducing omega-3 fatty acids or nutraceuticals or when we're introducing them. We then need to monitor and assess our response, and we need to constantly reevaluate this cycle. And we need to think about all the treatments that we have available and when is the optimal time to use them. And as I said earlier, this will vary from patient to patient. And we also need to think about surgical treatment and when we bring that into the mix of our treatment options. And in some cases that can be earlier, in other cases it may be, you know, saved until end stage disease where we might perform an arthrodesis or a joint replacement. But again, it needs to be considered throughout the lifetime of these patients and regularly re-evaluated. Another sort of approach to thinking about arthritis is staging the disease. And we don't really have time today to dwell on staging of the disease, but I think this will become more common in the future in terms of staging of the disease. You can review these slides again later, but one way of staging disease is to stage 1 to 4, and then obviously thinking about the treatment relative to the stage. And again, this treatment, the options for treatment down the right of that table are only suggestions, and different people might use them in different stages. So for example, regenerative medicines, some people might use early in the course of disease, which may be optimal. Other people may use it only for end stage joints. But again, we need to try and think about the disease, and we need to try and come up with clearer guidance, I think, in the future as to when different treatments. So going back to how do we choose the treatments? Well, choosing the treatment is based on the clinical stage of the disease. It should be based on evidence base. As I said before, we shouldn't just be reaching for the laser and using that. We need to be thinking of what's the evidence for this in this case. And we need to be using experience of people to choose the appropriate treatments. And we need to regularly reevaluate the decision. It's not a once yearly thing. It's once we've started, we need to be regularly monitoring it. We need to want to maximize the active lifespan of the pet. We want to be, you know, thinking about ongoing management. We need to be focusing on the mobility, muscle strength, and quality of life. If you have a dog where, you know, chronic joint pain is allowing that patient only to be allowed to exercise for 5 minutes once a day, otherwise it's in severe pain, well, we need to be evaluating the quality of life of that patient. We need to be supporting the owner, and we need to be proactive in our approach. We need to monitor treatment. We need to think about the clinical efficacy of treatment. We need to monitor for side effects, and we need to allow and think about titration of the different treatments that we're using. In relation to monitoring, very briefly here at the end, so in relation to monitoring treatment, the three main methods of monitoring treatment are owner observation, veterinary observation, there isn't really a gold standard for assessing the pain response or the response to treatment. And I think there are some tools that are becoming more and more available, those are patient assessment tools. There's no single patient assessment tool we can, you know, really recommend for all situations, but validated pain assessment tools can definitely offer improved potential for monitoring the effectiveness of treatment. And some examples are the canine specific outcome measure, the canine brief pain inventory, the Helsinki chronic pain index, the Glasgow University Veterinary School questionnaire, and the Liverpool osteoarthritis clinical metrology instrument, or the LODE. And by using these either with owners or for our own assessment as vets, then hopefully we can monitor treatment effectively. In relation to veterinary observation as well, something that can be useful, although you need a storage space for this, is video analysis. And I find it useful in the past to video a patient trotting up and down, sending it for physiotherapy and rehab and introducing all these sort of multimodal treatment, and then videoing them again. And often you can clearly see the benefits of treatment. And then there's the more quantitative assessments, so force plate, pressure mats and things, but they aren't really readily available in practice. So in summary, chronic joint pain is a common condition that we see in dogs. Osteoarthritis is definitely the most common cause of this, but we need to think about the underlying cause because that needs to be addressed. But even if we address it, ongoing management is going to be required. Conservative treatment options are available, and there's lots of them. We shouldn't just be reaching for one. We should be thinking about all of them, and we should be reevaluating which ones are working and introducing more. Remember that puzzle. And surgical options need to be considered. I think they can be offered to more patients than are currently available, and owners need to be made aware of these decisions early on, particularly like hip replacements and things, even if it's not appropriate at that time, so that they know what options are going to be available for them potentially in the future. Okay, so that's the end of the webinar. Let's just see, there's one question in at the moment. So one question is, what would I typically do for a dog that's been prescribed non-steroidals and hasn't really responded well, and it's had some physio and things as well? So that's quite common, you know, it's sort of had some basic physio, maybe some hydrotherapy, and has had non-steroidal treatment. Well, typically in that situation, I think it's important again to check the diagnosis, check there's not an underlying problem. So rule out sepsis, rule out polyarthritis, rule out cruciate disease if it's a stifle. And then once I'm happy that we're dealing with a chronic OA joint, then that's when I'll start potentially to try a different non-steroidal. So the washout period for the non-steroidal isn't really very clear, but typically I'll try and get it off the non-steroidal it's on for a week and then reintroduce a different non-steroidal and see if it responds to that. If it doesn't, then typically then I'll reach for tramadol or paracetamol and amantadine often at that stage. And I'll often hit it fairly hard at that stage if the pain is pretty advanced to think about the sort of central pain, and then I'll start to reduce once things are under control. Then my aim would be to get it back to just being on the licensed product of non-steroidal, but again it's sort of regularly evaluating the response to the treatment that's being given before making rush decisions. I think it's important not to just stab around in the dark and just give tramadol, it doesn't work, oh I'll add in amantadine and stop the tramadol. I think it's important to systematically think about how we're approaching. So that's a good question. So another question is regenerative. So as I sort of mentioned, you know, when would I use regenerative medicine, and when have I used regenerative medicine? So I think, as I said, it's becoming more and more readily available, and I worry that in practice there's more and more offerings of it, and people love reading about stem cells. They love to tell their friends their dogs having stem cells, but I think we need to think about the evidence, and the evidence at the moment is still limited, and I think it should be reserved for use where people are objectively assessing the outcome, or at least where other treatments are being used and monitored. So it's easy to say, well, I've given my dog regenerative medicine treatment and it's improved. Well, that could be because they've also started physiotherapy at that time as well, for example. So when do I use it? Well, typically we've started using it for ligamentous or tendon problems, so Achilles tendon problems. We might use platelet-rich plasma, but for chronic joint pain we've used it in a few dogs where they seem to be a bit refractory to the sort of mainstream treatments, and in those cases we've harvested stem cells or cultured stem cells and used those in the hip, one case where we used it in the hip joint, another in the stifle joint, and It has potentially resulted in an improvement in those cases, so it's made those dogs more comfortable, if not only in the short term. And we think it works by influencing inflammation within the joint, so reducing inflammation within the joint. I don't think it's, it's not resurfacing the joint, it's not getting rid of the osteophytes, but I think it's helping control the inflammation within the joint. So it's another important part of that puzzle where, for example, if non-steroidals haven't worked, then maybe using regenerative stem cells or platelet-rich plasma may help us reduce inflammation. Okay, so I think that's all of the questions. If there's any other questions, then feel free to send them in now. Otherwise, we'll end the webinar. So thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.